Welcome to The View magazine's Rebel Justice podcast. This podcast is part of our Someone's Daughter campaign, the campaign to change the way you see justice. This podcast was recorded during Photo London in September 2021. Photo London is an exceptional art and activism project where world-famous and acclaimed photographers have taken photographs of women who have been involved in the criminal justice system. Some are survivors, some are lawyers, some are activists, and others are leading women in public life who have taken an interest in all the processes, from charging and arrest, from incarceration to rehabilitation. Today, we look at whether women with lived experience can be part of the solution when it comes to effective policy and stopping the cycle of crime and reducing reoffending. Today's panel includes model and mental health campaigner Naomi Harlow, activist and former prisoner Claire Barstow, prison law solicitor and expert Rob Welsh from our sponsors InstaLaw, a leading prison and criminal defense law firm, and former prisoner and one of the founders of The View, Farah Damji. Thank you all for coming. Naomi, I will bring you in first. Could you tell us about your experience with working with younger women and how lived experience can be used to support them?
I've worked for a number of years with children and young people. And I think some of the most understanding and some of the most compassionate people working with those children and young people are the people who've lived through a similar experience. I think it's a tricky line between using your lived experience to support others and it influencing how you view their trauma. So you have to be quite careful. I personally have lived through similar experiences to a lot of the children that I work with, but my trauma is not the same as their trauma, and my experience of dealing with trauma is not the same as theirs is going to be. So I think it's a case of being very aware that although your lived experience can educate and inform your practice, that you are also being very conscious of the fact that you're not healing your own wounds through supporting them. So I've worked with children with various, all kinds of trauma, so poverty, sexual abuse, mental abuse, peer-on-peer abuse, county lines, all of this kind of work. And I think that the one thing that they all have in common is that if we're not very careful, children and young people who've lived through those things come out of them with a feeling of worthlessness and a feeling a little bit, depending on the support they've received, of possibly feeling a little bit like they've been thrown under the bus, that's kind of their script is written and that's the end of it. So it's enabling people to work through trauma, but also own the trauma and not see them completely as victims for their whole life. I think that's really key because we like to victimize trauma victims because it helps us to see them as people in need, and actually what we need to do is see them as strong people who still are people in need, and that can inform how we best support them.
Rob, how do you feel about your experience as a solicitor within mental health cases you have come across?
Just as a bit of background, I work primarily with the male estate but also with the female prison estate, and there are quite a few differences between the two. I would say the female estate is probably slightly better catered to in terms of mental health, but still not anywhere near enough. And I think the things which I have identified over the years is that people are not given enough time individually to try and assess the issues which they have been encountering in their life. It's very much one box fits all. And I guess the issue, when it's ultimately broken down, comes down to finances and resources. The prison system would work far better if there were more and more psychologists and people able to aid people who have suffered with trauma, rather than trying to paper the cracks and forget all about that and pretend that issue is going to go away after they've finished a sentence. And of course, this is why we end up in the male and female estate, where ultimately the cycle isn't broken and people back to prison because we've never actually got to the bottom the issue as to why it happened in the first place. We just keep sending people back to prison and think that that's going to resolve the problem. And of course it isn't. So yeah, that's my concise view of the position.
So do you think it's important to prioritise more alternatives to custody for those who have mental health issues?
Very much so. And again, I think this has got to come down to the individual. People have got to be ready to change and in a position to change, but continually putting people in custody, in my view, is simply not the answer. There needs to be very good one-to-one work with people at the very first stages of prison. That simply doesn't happen at the moment. People come to prison and, you know, they're interviewed briefly, and if they're, you know, not in a critical position, they may get put on the waiting list for mental health services and so forth. And that can often take months, in my experience, for people to obtain that help. And meanwhile, their mental health deteriorates further and further because of the effect of being put in prison as well. So it's a kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. And ultimately, if they don't get the help that they require when they come out of prison, you know, they've been made worse, essentially, and they've suffered more. And the staying in prison has acted as a traumatic experience for them on top of the trauma which they have already had. So yeah, certainly in the majority of cases, unless there is a real imminent risk to the public, alternatives should be explored in terms of and over and above prison sentences.
Claire, I see you have something to say.
Yes. Yeah, my experience as well, I found that a lot of women really struggle to get access to mental health services in prison. And yeah, the way, as you said, the waiting lists are huge, and sometimes it wasn't fast enough or effective enough. So, so I think really the whole of the healthcare system in prison probably needs an overhaul, really, for those who are most desperately in need.
Yes. Farah, what was your experience of the way prisons look at mental health?
I'm just completely useless. I mean, there was no mental health support at all. You have to beg and ask. I mean, as you know, you don't really see the psychiatrist or the psychologist. It's all done through the nurse that you see in the morning who gives you your medication if you see someone for morning meds. But the referral process is completely broken, and then you're told that you're not ill enough, you know, that your problem, there are women with a lot worse diagnoses than you. So it's belittled, it's not treated seriously. It compounds the trauma that's already there, because if you feel unheard and your experiences are invalidated again, and then you're being re-traumatized in this environment, you know, where there is physical violence and emotional abuse all over the place. You see it all over the place. So I think I think just to echo what Rob was saying, prison is not the place for women with mental health issues, and judges know that. You know, judges are aware of that, but unfortunately it's seen as a place to put women who are if you look at this issue of The View, I don't know if you've all got it yet, it's been a little bit late coming out, but you'll see we've got a really interesting interview with a judge, and he says one of the reasons that he sends women to prison, well, people to prison, is if they're sort of a nuisance in the community, if they've exhausted all of the kind of community services and things available. So I think we need to re-examine our how we're using prisons and who they're for. But then this raises all the issues about, you know, money and finance and who's profiting. And I've just had to have a court report done yesterday, actually, and it was £4,000. So who's profiting from this? You know, he was on Zoom with me for about an hour and a half, I think, and, you know, he'll read the thousands and thousands of pages. But we need to look at, if you consider it costs £10,000 a day to open a Crown Court, and no offense at all meant to solicitors or barristers, you know, in any way, Rob, but we just need to look at who's profiting, who's benefiting, and who's being harmed, I think, you know, in the system as it exists, because mental health contracts are worth hundreds of millions of pounds a year, yet, you know, most people in prison who need them can't access them.
This is a great point as well. Rob?
Great. If I may come back on some of those points, because it's fascinating things which I've been saying to people who would listen to me for years, and coming back to the financials of the issue, we know in the male estate it can range between £30,000 to £50,000 a year to keep somebody in prison, and people have been waiting years and years to undertake accredited courses, so the taxpayer has been paying that amount of money each year for hundreds and hundreds of inmates because they're waiting to undertake a course which a psychologist was run. And instead of employing more psychologists for the prison, the mathematical equation goes into complete disarray. So the government would rather pay £40,000 a year to keep the inmate there rather than pay £40,000 to £50,000 for a prison psychologist to get pews down. So I think everything you've said about who's profiting is very relevant indeed. And it appears that people in the heart of it don't receive much funding at all. Whereas, you know, as I say, the wider aspects, perhaps they do. And you're right about the psychologist reports as well. In comparison to how legal aid lawyers are paid, for one report a psychologist does, it's probably three or four times the amount that the lawyer would receive for representing the inmate at a very important hearing. So, yeah.
And the burnout is so, I mean, I have a lot of friends who are solicitors and barristers, and the burnout and the despair at the moment is just so vocal, you know, that I think that I'm not completely up to date with it, but I think they're talking about striking again because the conditions, you know, trials are getting pulled at the last minute. The conditions in courtrooms, some of the physical conditions are so disgusting as well. And, you know, so this trauma is kind of, it's like a nut, and then it's just growing and growing and growing, and it's impacting all of the people involved. So solicitors are getting traumatized because there isn't, you can't do this on a shoestring. You have to be properly paid, you know, to do a good job. And I know legal aid budgets have shrunk. Is it 37% or something? I mean, it's huge, isn't it? To do the same amount of work for one third less money.
This is it, and I've been doing this job since 2005, and in the area of prison law, there has not been a single increase in price since that time. In fact, quite the opposite. We've had two cuts since 2005, so a lot of people are leaving the profession, and they are going to prosecuting instead, so we are going to have a real problem with protecting people's rights in the future, because they're simply not going to be the qualified lawyers to be able to do it, because they're not coming into the industry, because they know they're not going to be paid, you know, they're probably going to be paid a third as much as their counterpart who works for the prosecution.
Yeah, and the problem is also that some solicitors, unless you're lucky enough to get somebody who has got a lot of experience, they might not know. They might not engage an independent psychologist to do a report, say at a LIFER panel. And that could be the difference between somebody staying inside another 2 years or getting out. And obviously with, as you said, with the cut in legal aid, it's getting harder and harder. You know, I went on the march, the Howard League organising, the legal aid march that happens, I think, most years, where people are marching to try and raise money for legal aid. And I went as part of the Howard League group because I'm a member of that. But there was so, to see all these solicitors marching just to get access to money to help people in the most difficult circumstances in prison, and particularly people with mental health issues, it's quite scary that this is having to, people having to recourse to this because the government won't give enough funding, and that's going to have a knock-on effect, and as you say, it's going to result in people being in prison longer, which again is going to cost about £60,000 a year to keep somebody in prison. It's just like an endless cycle, isn't it? I think, and that's the problem.
Thank you, Claire. Naomi, how do you feel about this in connection to the young women you work with?
So I think what I experience a lot of is when I'm working with children, we have a lot of sympathy for children who are being traumatised, quite rightly. But as soon as they hit, and it seems to be around 14, I think the sympathy turns to that kind of lazy kind of, well, why don't they do this? Why don't they try this? And I think that we have to be very careful. And the middle classes in particular, and some of this is a class issue, unfortunately, will view a lot of women's experience through the prism of their own experience. So they're judging everything that choices that women make as, well, I wouldn't have done that. And why doesn't she do this? And why doesn't she do this? And I think, as Rob said, he said, you know, that he mentioned something about being able to make choices. And I think that's really, really key. I think if we are going into, if we're viewing the prison system as, you have done something wrong, you knew better, you need to come in here and learn how to do it better. And then when you go back out, you need to do it right this time. And we've taught you now. That's what we're viewing it as, which it seems largely that it is seen that way. We're completely missing the point that, A, was it even a choice? Is this a survival issue? And B, are people capable? Are they in a position to make the choices that we're expecting them to make? Are they capable of changing without significant support? And I think my answer to that would be, well, no, the vast majority are not. And equally, we have the issue of, as has been mentioned, this re-traumatising. So if you're taking somebody whose trauma involves things like lack of control, disempowerment, sexual abuse, mental health issues, putting him into somewhere like a prison is almost literally the worst place that they can be put. Now, really interestingly, I took a cab yesterday, and the driver was a prison officer. So he asked me where I was going, and I explained a little bit about the magazine. And he was a prison officer for 26 years in a high security prison initially, and then in women's and young offenders. And he said that it was really interesting to him that from coming from the inside, he said that he didn't see enough of the idea that we have of, you know, well, there's a TV and they can do these courses and they have this kind of support. And he said, we didn't see that. He said a lot of that is lip service. And he said that in male prisons, what he noticed was a lot of externalized violence. So there'd be a violence of prisoner against prisoner. But for women in women's prisons and young offenders institutes, it was self-harm, eating disorders, because women and young people, on the whole, are much more likely to turn their trauma inwards on themselves. And he said, you know, there was a lot of noise made about making sure they don't have sharp objects, making sure that things aren't available to them to harm themselves, and nowhere near enough on why they're harming themselves in the first place. So it was seen as a kind of, oh, you know, now they're acting up about this, let's take that away from them, but not nearly enough about, well, why is somebody sitting in their cell and self-harming? So I think all of the points that have been raised are absolutely true, that unless you can categorically prove that a person is a risk to the community, prison is rarely going to be the best option. And in terms of funding, I mean, the costs that we're talking about in terms of, you know, mental health and keeping people in the prison system are absolutely vast. And I don't see that there can be a significant amount more money involved if we're talking about rehabilitation centres. You know, if we're thinking that prison, you know, you need a prison guard, you need a nurse, you need to keep prisons running, they need heating, there's food, there's all of these things. I don't understand where those figures come from, that there's not enough money to do that, particularly when what we're looking at is the likelihood of reoffending being so extremely high. Surely you could argue if we rehabilitate once and problems not solved, but problem improved, well, how is that financially or fiscally viable then to just have somebody on this treadmill of imprisonment, release, imprisonment, release, imprisonment, release? So I dispute the funding as an issue, really. I think it's bad planning and I think it's laziness, because I think people want something to be seen to be done. They want people to go to prison if they've made bad choices, as in, well, I wouldn't do that, and they have, so that's how it is. As if it's some kind of social naughty step that we just send people to so that we don't have to deal with them anymore. And as soon as you start talking about things like rehabilitation, financials taken out of the equation, people immediately have this, but why should they have that? And why should they have that? And I've been on waiting list for therapy for 6 months, and why should they have that? And the answer is, what do you want these outcomes to be? If you want these outcomes to improve, this is what needs to happen. So, yeah, I completely agree that prison is rarely going to be the best option unless somebody is a significant proven risk to the community.
Sorry, there's been a million words written on exactly what you've said, that justice reinvestment, it's called, where you take money that's in crime and police and court budgets and you put it into community solutions, mental health, social services, social justice kind of outcomes. So there's been, I don't know how many reports. I mean, there's Lord Wolf, The Strange Ways, there's Lord Farmer, there's the Bradley report, there's the Causton report, there's, endless reports, and everyone agrees that what we're doing is not the right thing to do. So when you start to, I think the problem is trauma. I think when you ask people to look at the trauma that we're all involved in causing, because actually we're paying for this, you know, we're paying to fund this abusive and harmful system. I think it's really hard to hold that thought that actually my taxpayers' money, you know, your contributions are being used to pay that. And it's easier to shut that argument out of your head and just go for the Daily Mail narrative, which is, she's a woman, she committed a crime, she must be Myra Hindley. Let's just lock her up and throw away the key. So it's really, you know, there's that, everyone, when you approach it rationally like you are and say the costs are too much, there has to be a better solution, that's kind of where the stumbling block is for everyone. And I think that's the thing that's really hard to overcome for most people.
Claire?
Yeah, because I was at the launch of when the Centre for Social Justice launched a report, the latest, that a couple of years ago, and where they were looking at, they basically accepted that around 70% or more of the women had who ended up in prison or committing an offence had undergone massive trauma, and it was more common amongst women than men, although obviously it does happen with the male estate. But and there that, you know, and the report basically said about all these alternatives to custody. At the time, the prison minister at the time, and he was agreeing with it all. And it sounded like things might eventually, this is a move on from Causton, and things might eventually change. But then the problem was, they said, oh, yes, we the government keep on saying, oh, yes, we're looking at solutions. But then they're thinking about building a prison in Wales with 500. Places a new prison instead of looking at, you know, putting that money into the things that they say they agree with. So it's very difficult, I think.
Yes. Rob, how do you feel about this, building new prisons versus lack of openness for other solutions?
I think the points that have been made by everyone contributing have been extremely valid, and I think it boils down to political issues and essentially parties wanting to keep and maintain their popularity with the general public, because the reality is there isn't a great deal of sympathy for people in prison and offenders in the general public. It has certainly been my experience in other forums when I've spoken to people. And I think because of that, ultimately, political parties are frightened of losing votes and so forth if they are deemed to be treating inmates, you know, and so forth, leniently, when of course that isn't the reality at all. And that's why these events and talks are so important. Try and educate the wider public as much as anything else, that people do need help and there are other alternatives to prison, then it's not, you know, an easy ride, because we are suggesting these alternatives to people. One of the things that crops up with other people I've spoken about a lot is regarding the help people get, training in prison and so forth, and qualifications people can undertake, and that's a fundamentally important part of the prison system as I view it. But when I've spoken to people about the kind of qualifications some people have obtained in prison, they have said to me, well, why should they get the money for those qualifications? I have to pay for that when I'm out. And my answer to that is, well, you don't need the help. It's akin to giving people disability allowance. We give it to people who need it, and the people who need it are the people who have suffered trauma, who are in prison, you know, who need investing it. And that's the only way you're going to try and help people break this cycle of coming back to prison again and again.
Thank you so much, Rob, and thanks to all the panelists. That brings to a close our first part of 3 of this podcast, included in our Someone's Daughter podcast series, a discussion today which has been about the role of women who have lived experience and may be part of the solution to the entrenched problems of reoffending and crime. So stay tuned for the next part of this podcast coming next week. Thank you so much, Naomi Harlow, Rob Walsh, Farah Damji, and Claire Barstow. The View would also like to thank leading law firm InstaLaw and Guernica 37 Legal Chambers for their sponsorship and support of Someone's Daughter, experts in prison law and human rights, defending the rights of people across the world. You can go online and search for Someone's Daughter to see powerful women photographed by world-renowned and acclaimed photographers, read their stories in The View magazine, and be inspired by these very shocking narratives, but also by these excellent constructive solutions. I'm Maddalena Alberto, and this Rebel podcast is a production of The View magazine. You can find The View magazine across our social media, where we are Rebel Justice. The View magazine is available online via subscription and as a digital download on theviewmag.org.uk. Support, amplify, donate.